Welcome to another special American Cassette Ministry seminar featuring Clifford Goldstein, editor of Shabbat Shalom magazine and writer for Liberty magazine. This four-part seminar is devoted to helping you learn how to derive the date for the beginning of the heavenly investigative judgment using your Bible alone. And for your convenience, we have enclosed visual aids showing the key scriptural texts and historical dates. During our first presentation, we will focus on the seventh chapter of Daniel in the Old Testament. Now, here is Clifford Goldstein to introduce our seminar.
I'll never forget the thrill of emerging from darkness, from the darkness of agnosticism, skepticism, even spiritualism. I used to be into spiritualism. Into emerging from all that into the light of the three angels' message. The Lord lifted me from sin. He lifted me from death. He lifted me from the alienation that comes from an estrangement from God. And elevated me not only into a knowledge of Jesus as the Messiah, but into Adventism, into present truth, into what is unquestionably the most important movement on the earth today. And yet all was not well in Zion when I came into the church, which was about 8 years ago. I joined this church amid rumors and rumblings and questions and rebellion and so forth. But in the very beginning, in my newborn innocence, most of it passed me by. I was like a newborn babe, just smiling and laughing, basically unaware of some of the bitter lessons that life has to offer us. Well, I had been an Adventist not more than 3 months when a friend of mine told me about an Adventist professor out in California who was denying 1844. I looked my friend right in the face and I said, "Who cares? I didn't care about 1844. You know, I had seen the charts. I had read about 1844, and I believed it because Ellen White believed it, and I believed in what Ellen White believed. But who cared? 1844, it seemed irrelevant to me. How important was that to me? How really important was it? I mean, all I ever talked about in the first 6 months as an Adventist was the mark of the beast anyway. I mean, every Bible study I gave was on the mark of the beast. I told everybody and his brother about the mark of the beast. I mean, I used to write graffiti on bathroom walls about the mark of the beast, and people would come to me and say, "Were you in such and such a restaurant? I saw your writings on the bathroom walls." I mean, 1844, it seemed irrelevant. Who cared? Well, about 4 months later, I found myself in the midst of my first Adventist ghetto. First time, I was just barely in the church. And I was in this Adventist ghetto. Well, here the rumors and the rumblings about 1844 there were more than rumors. It was all anybody talked about. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, between meals, the sanctuary, 1844, blah, blah, blah. And all this hoopla was going on and all these things were going on. And again, I was only an Adventist 6-7 months. I don't know what all the hoopla was about. But I knew one thing, though. I knew one thing. Nobody or nothing was going to shake me. Well, so I thought. But then people started confronting me with questions. They started asking me questions like, "How do you get 1844? How do you get an 1844 investigative judgment out of the Bible? How do you know the year-day principle is valid? People said to me. And they said, even if it is valid, how are you sure you apply it to Daniel 7, to Daniel 8, or to Daniel 9? How can you be sure you apply it there? How do you tie Daniel 8 and Daniel 9 together? People say you can't tie. What are the links between Daniel 8 and Daniel 9? People say there really weren't links there. Why was there no verbal link between the word for cleansed in Leviticus 16 and the word that's translated cleansed in the King James Version? How come there's no verbal link there? They say, how do you know the 2300 evening and mornings of Daniel is really 2300 days? It's not 1150 days, the way at least one translation has it. They ask me questions, can't you see how the book of Hebrews puts Christ in the second apartment? I mean, you read Hebrews, how can you talk about 1844 when Hebrews clearly puts Christ in the second apartment? And they ask a lot of questions like this. What about the little horn power? Antiochus Epiphanes. Isn't the little horn Antiochus Epiphanes? And by the way, they said, did you know how much Ellen White really copied? Now, the situation for me at that time was, I was 8 months in the church. 8 months. I mean, 8 months before, I didn't know Seventh-day Adventists from Mormons. Came in and I was suddenly thrown into this quagmire. And I had no answers for these questions. And what was even more disheartening to me were that people who I expected to have answers, they didn't have them either. They were shaking. People either attacked the doctrine outright or expressed skepticism about it. You know, I felt like, I don't know, before I was an Adventist, I had seen this movie called The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And this was a movie about how these aliens came down and would take over the bodies of people in a town. And they looked alike, talked alike, sounded like everything was alike, but they were really aliens. And it was from the perspective of this viewpoint of this doctor. And all around him, everywhere he turned, bit by bit, there were aliens. The people were becoming aliens till he was alone. He felt like he was the only one left in the whole town. Everywhere he looked, there were aliens. He felt he was all alone. He didn't know where to trust, where to turn to. He, though, was the only one that managed to escape. But I'll tell you what happened to me. I didn't escape. I became one of them. I sat down, I would open my Bible, I would read Daniel 8:14 and say, I can't get 1844 out of the Bible. I mean, one of my friends would come out of town, one of the people that led me in the church, and said, let's look at it. He says, I don't want to look at Daniel 8. It depresses me too much. I lost my faith in 1844. And before long, I came to the conclusion and the implications of that not being biblical staggered me. Instantly, my faith in the whole Adventist message crumbled. I don't care who you are, if you're any kind of logical thinker, I mean, if 1844 is not biblical, the first thing that absolutely has to go is Ellen G. White. If that is not biblical, Ellen White is a false prophet in the same class as Mary Baker Eddy, Joseph Smith, Sun Myung Moon. She's worse because the deception is even deeper. That's the first thing that went out. I mean, she became zilch to me once I lost faith in that. Then the idea of Adventism being the remnant church, I just started to doubt. I thought, well, that can't be. I mean, if 1844 is not biblical, Adventism is not biblical. I started to wonder about the law, the Sabbath. I mean, I believe you should keep it, but was it really that important? Was it going to be really that? Is it really all that important as I started watching my faith crumble? I started to question everything. Even the mark of the beast. When I started to wonder, was my whole experience with God a fluke too? I say it before, I say it again. If 1844 is not biblical, then we are a false church preaching a false message. Well, I poured out my soul in prayer to God, pleading for help. I mean, if this message was true, I wanted out. I mean, I hadn't been an Adventist that long. the church didn't mean that much to me. Besides, I never really liked being a vegetarian. I really didn't. You know, and even to this day, when I see meat, I got to kind of grind, dig my heels in and keep going because I just love to eat meat. I mean, my aggressive search for truth. See, I had been an aggressive searcher for truth, and Sabbath I'm going to talk about my conversion story. I mean, I wanted truth no matter what. And I was led to Adventism. I thought, well, if this isn't truth, I'm just going to keep on searching. Because if it wasn't true, I want it out. So I decided I was going to go back to where this whole problem started. I'm going to go back where the whole problem started for me to begin with. And it was this 1844 thing. And I said to myself, if I can't get this out of the Bible without any Ellen White, because at that point Ellen White was about as authoritative to me as a Tibetan Book of the Dead. I said, if I can't get 1844 out of the Bible and the Bible alone without Ellen White, I was going to pack my bags and I was just going to move back. I was living in the Middle East when I became a believer in Jesus. And I was just getting ready to move back to Israel and just keep on searching. So I prayed. Because as I said, simple logic, if you're any kind of logical thinker, if 1844 is not biblical, then our church is a fraud. Our message is a fraud. Our prophet is a fraud. We might as well go join evangelical Christianity. If you can really think about it logically, I don't know how you could come to any other conclusion. I couldn't. So, I prayed. I studied. I really sought for an understanding of truth because I knew the direction of my whole life, even my eternal life, could have possibly been at stake with this study. And as I said, I used no Ellen White whatsoever. A few weeks later, I finished. And I came to a conclusion. And my conclusion was simply this. If you were to use the Old Testament alone, not counting the New, just the Old, you have as much evidence for an 1844 investigative judgment as you have for Jesus of Nazareth being the Messiah. That was a no Ellen White. Now before, when I read Daniel 8, I couldn't imagine how anybody could look at it and see, how can you get a judgment out of here? After, when my eyes were open and I looked at it again, I thought, how can you read Daniel 8 and not see the judgment? After that experience, I was more convicted of Adventism and the truth of this message than I had ever been. Only then did I realize how weak my founding had been, not being grounded in the sanctuary. And instantly, the first thing that happened, all my doubts, all my qualms, everything about Ellen White just vanished. And I thought to myself, surely, I mean, that old lady, she knew what she was talking about. I mean, if anything, my faith in Ellen White, since I understood 1844 and got grounded in 1844, and it's enabled me to see Ellen White as the greatest prophet of them all. But once I got solid on that, my understanding of 1844 gave me a whole new experience with Jesus, with Adventism, with spirit of prophecy. I mean, it was as I was born again, so to speak. I mean, it was like I was raised from the dead. Once I saw how biblical 1844 was, all my doubts about everything just vanished. Just completely vanished like that. And what it tells me too is that despite apostasies, despite our Laodicean malaise, despite scandals, despite anything and everything that happens within the church itself, 1844 proves beyond question that Adventism is the remnant church. And unless you see that, unless you really understand that, I mean, the judgment, more than the state of the dead, more than the Sabbath, because a lot of these things are believed by other churches. But But I believe 1844 itself, more than anything else, establishes the validity of our message and makes us who we are today, whether we realize it or not. Until you see the truth of 1844, I'm convinced, and what happened there, until you see that, realizing that we are the only ones that have it, you will never fully understand what the Adventist mission is and what present truth is and what our message really is for the world. I mean, you could be a converted soul, love the Lord, on and on, but you won't have a complete grasp of what we are supposed to be about. Yet, I went on my merry way, okay? I went on my merry way with an Adventism after that experience. And I can't, but it was amazed me because everywhere I went, everywhere I would go, I would meet Adventists. Young, old, white, black, converts or lifers on the east, from the west, whatever. Liberal, conservative, however you want to describe them. And almost none of them could get 1844 out of the Bible. Lifelong Adventists say, well, I don't know, I can't get, who cares, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I mean, I would go around and I would meet so many Adventists who would be this way. I have stood in front of churches of 300 people and I have said, how many of you can get, using your Bible alone without any Ellen White, how many of you could get 1844 out of the Bible? 300 people, and maybe three or four would raise their hand. Time and time again, three or four people would raise their hands. I mean, the mass of American Adventism could not give an intelligent study on 1844, the investigative judgment, if their life depended on it. The vast majority. I'm not even going to ask you here to raise your hands, but I almost guarantee you that most of you here, well, I don't know, the fact that people come to this shows that there's interest. You're interested in this. You probably haven't heard a sermon about 1844 or read about it in years. In years. You can be converted. You can be a loyal, tithe-paying, vigilant-eating, Sabbath-keeping Seventh-day Adventist. You can be give Bible studies. You can win souls to Christ. You can be a loving and lovable Christian. But I'm telling you, because I know from experience, if you are not grounded in this 1844 message, in this sanctuary doctrine, then you are ill. Notice what I'm saying? Ill prepared to deal with the shaking and the trouble that we are going to face. Had I, though 8 years ago, been confronted with the storm that we know that's going to come upon us, the only way we're going to be attacked. Had I been attacked with that 8 years ago, I would have been blown out like a leaf in a tornado. I mean, I would have gone out like that. Now, I'm not talking about salvation by theology. An understanding of 1844, an understanding of 1844. This does not save you. This isn't what's going to save you. But people do perish for a lack of knowledge. Bible says that. And we as a people are woefully, with all the light that's shining right around us, that's right in front of us, I'm amazed at how much darkness really is within our church. Now, perhaps you've never been confronted with this issue before. Perhaps you've never really thought about 1844 and the implications of it. You will one day, though. We have been warned that everything that can be shaken will be shaken. And as a people, I don't even think we begin to comprehend what the shaking involves. What's going to be involved in that. But I mean, the devil's going to come at us from all directions, from every angle. If you have a hard time believing in 1844, you start doubting 1844. You know, it's going to be hard enough to lose your homes, lose your jobs, maybe even lose your life for a doctrine and a teaching that you do believe. But if you start doubting 1844, you start questioning that, you're going to lose your life over a doctrine that you have questions about to begin with. You're going to lose your life over that. You're going to have your homes taken away, your family taken away from a doctrine that you can't even get out of the Bible. Again, you might not think it's important now. I didn't think it was important until I was confronted with it. And I saw the implications of what happens when people come and attack that doctrine and you don't have answers for it. The 1844 investigative judgment, this is the theological pillar of our church, yet it sits like a dusty relic in the Adventist family closet. We all know it's there. We're not sure what to do with it. Nobody really wants to bother with it. We're not sure how to handle it and so forth, so we tend to try to ignore it. Yet once it goes, I'm telling you, Adventism goes with it. Which is why the devil is working so well to make us apathetic about it, to make us in darkness about it, or to put doubts in our minds about it. You know, how clever of the devil to set aside one of our most basic doctrines, because he knows that once he kicks that out completely, everything is going to crash. And I believe all he's doing, he's just waiting for the right moment when he could take out as many of us as he can hope that he can. Now again, I'm not talking about speculation here, a theory. I know from my own experience what happened to me with this. Once they kicked that out from underneath me, if you can think logically at all, from A to B to C at all, everything goes. I know because everything went for me. But now I have seen how much confidence, how much strength, how much assurance that doctrine and understanding of that doctrine has given me for the message. I mean, this is a thing which makes me know beyond question that this is the remnant church. That we have got the only hope. We've got the message that's the only hope for the world, for a dying world. Well, anyway, a while back I did a series of tapes with American Cassette Ministries. A series called 1844 Made Simple, which is just a study on this 1844. And what it is just what we're going to spend for the next few days is we're just going to study how you get the date 1844 out of the Bible. I don't go into what happened there, what's the importance. I have a sequel to that, to this study called Investigating the Judgment, which says, okay, you believe in 1844 is biblical. What does it mean? What is the importance? What is the relevance for our lives today? Because even people that believe in 1844 can't see the significance of it. But what we're going to do today in the next few days is we're going to simply study the mechanics of how you get the date out of the Bible. Just the date, because I mean, if you get that, everything else will fall into place. Okay, one final note before we begin. In this study, I use absolutely no Ellen White. Some people argue that Ellen White was not a theologian and therefore no good for theology and whatnot. And I suppose in the classical sense of the word, Ellen White was not a theologian. She was a prophet. And I would take the word of a prophet over any theologian, anytime, anywhere, any place. I don't care how many letters he's got behind his name, how eloquent, how many languages he knows. I'll take the prophet with a third grade education. Yet, I'm telling you, don't base your belief and your understanding of 1844 on Ellen White. Don't use Ellen White to get solid on the Bible. I'm telling you. I found that out the hard way. You get solid on the Bible. You get solid on this message in the Bible. And you will be solid on her and nothing will be able to shake you. Because once you see this is biblical, you'll know beyond question, hey, she was everything we believed. And we have believed that she is. Base 1844 on the Bible and you'll stand unmovable on Ellen White. Use her as your base for 1844. And I guarantee you, sooner or later, somehow or another, both of them will crumble from underneath you. I know from my own experience. We're going to divide this seminar. There's going to be four meetings. First three meetings we're going to deal with simply how you get the date out of the Bible. And then the last meeting, we're going to have is going to deal with answers to objections, answers to some of the questions that have come up. I don't want to get bogged down in each step dealing with it because I want to go through the study, and then we'll come down and I'll have some questions that I'll deal with, some of the major questions that you might have heard, and then we'll have a time for question and answers. And if you have any questions, let's wait till after, because last time I gave the seminar a couple weeks ago in my home church, I decided I'd let the people ask questions while we're doing the seminar, and we were there for hours. And I don't want to do that. I want to get through the essence of the study. Afterwards, you have questions. And the last meeting, when we deal with some of the major arguments that have come up against the sanctuary, we'll use that as a time to really look at some of these questions. Okay. Said unto me, after 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. We say this refers to a judgment of believers that began in the year 1844. What we're going to look at this week, this weekend, is particularly the date, how we get the date 1844 out of that text. That's what we're going to look at. Now, first question. Did the investigative judgment occur in AD 31 or after? This question, the answer to this can really make or break Adventism. If, as some have claimed, the judgment occurred in AD 31 with Jesus at the cross and Jesus' ascension into heaven, then the 1844 becomes nothing but what our enemies have said it is. Just a face-saving device concocted by, you know, the Millerites who are trying to weasel their way out of the great disappointment. That's all it becomes if the judgment began in AD 31. Now, did the judgment occur in AD 31? I've got a few texts here I want you to read. Because he has appointed a day in which he will judge the world. Acts 17:31. And he reasoned of righteousness and temperance and judgment to come. Acts 24:25. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. Romans 2:16. For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So then every one of us shall give an account of himself to God. Romans 14:10 and 12. And Hebrews 10:30. And again, the Lord shall judge his people. These few texts, and there are other ones, but I just picked out a few. They have a few things in common. And the first thing they have in common, perhaps the most obvious, is that they all came from where? The New Testament. Okay? Store that on a gray shelf. New Testament. And what are they all talking about? They're talking about a judgment. Okay? Is that clear? Everybody see this here? New Testament text talking about a judgment. Now, look at the timing of this judgment here. What does the timing of this judgment, what are they talking about this judgment? In the future, can you see that? God will judge the world and the Lord shall judge his people. So every one of us shall give an account unto God, for we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So now look what we have here. We have New Testament texts referring to a future judgment of Christians. Okay? And because the New Testament was written when? After the cross. How many years after the cross? 10, 20, 30 years after the cross? So you've got New Testament texts written 10, 20, 30 years after the cross, all pointing to a yet future judgment. What does that tell you about the judgment in relationship to the cross? It would occur after AD 31. Can you see the point? Simple point. You've got New Testament texts written years after the cross pointing to a judgment that occurs in the future. Now, again, it's crucial. This is a simple point, but it's crucial, because if the people who place a judgment in AD 31, our message crumbles. Now you say, what about the text, though? I used to have to listen to this all the time, and never mind, I'm not going to say that. I used to have to listen to this text. For example, John 12:31, where Jesus says, now is the judgment of the world. Jesus spoke. So people say, here's your proof. The investigative judgment was at coming. Jesus was talking about his death and the cross. Therefore, 1844 is not biblical. Now, sure, in one sense, a judgment occurred at the cross. No one's going to deny that. I mean, here the spotless Son of God came to the earth in human flesh, poured out all that the heaven could give, only to be despised, be rejected of men, and eventually crucified. The whole world, in a sense, stands condemned, stands judged for the death of the Son of God. But no one in that sense, a judgment occurred. But not the investigative judgment. You know, the Bible talks about different types of judgments. I mean, a judgment came on the earth when sin entered. The flood was a judgment. Ancient Israel faced judgments. You know, there'll be a judgment when Jesus comes back. We will be involved in the millennial judgment. There's going to be the executive judgment when sin and sinners are finally obliterated. But what type of judgment are many of these texts here referring to? This is an important point. Paul said that we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Paul included himself in that. We shall all. Is Paul a believer? Paul a Christian, so to speak? Who was he writing to? Was he writing to other believers? They all, including Paul, were to be judged by God. Believers are judged. I mean, can you see that the Lord shall judge his people? One of the other heresies I used to have to deal with, I don't want to get off on that one, is people say, nowhere to God's people, we're not judged. We're not condemned. There is therefore no condemnation to those who are in Jesus Christ. But see, look at some of these texts here. And again, the Lord shall judge his people. For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So obviously we are dealing with some of these texts here, a judgment of whom? Who's going to be judged? His people. And God shall judge his people. So you got the New Testament pointing to a yet future judgment of God's people. So what does that obviously tell you about the judgment of God's people in relationship to AD 31? It had to come after AD 31. Is that clear? Can you see that point right here? Again, it's simple, but it's crucial. Because people that put it at AD 31, I don't know what they do. I don't know what kind of argument they give for these kind of texts. But here you've got clear text pointing to a judgment of believers that occurs after AD 31. Okay. But we could see that the judgment of God's people occurs after AD 31. We're still a long way. We've got a long way to go before we narrow that down to 1844. We'll narrow it down specifically to that date. But we're going to spend a little bit of time trying to narrow it down closer and closer. Now, we're going to spend the rest of our time in the book of Daniel. And we're going to start out in Daniel 2. I just want to spend a few minutes in Daniel 2 because I'm assuming that most of you have a rudimentary knowledge of Daniel 2. Though I've learned a long time ago, it's dangerous to assume our people really know anything. It's a sad situation, but what can you do? But Daniel 2, Most Adventists are familiar with Daniel, so I just want to spend a few minutes because there's 2 points I want to bring up from Daniel 2. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon has a dream. He can't remember the dream, much less interpret it. So he gets all the soothsayers and all the wise men to tell him the dream. They can't do it. He's going to kill them all. Daniel comes, one of the Jewish boys from Israel, the captives from Judah. He comes. He says, take it easy. God can answer it for you. He prays. He gets in an answer to the dream. Okay? The dream we know, of course, was this great image. Nebuchadnezzar saw that great stone image. The head was of gold, the breasts and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, the legs were of iron, the feet were part iron and part clay. Then we know in verse 34 and 35 that a huge stone smote the image upon its feet that were of iron and clay and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken into pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. It's interesting because in Jewish thought, this is the coming of the Messiah and the setting up of the messianic kingdom. The stone cut out without hands. And later on, I'm going to get into some of the Jewish perspectives on the sanctuary. And it's amazing to see how the Jews had our message 1,500 years ago. They were preaching our message. We're just coming along and kind of tightening up their theology on it a little bit. It's interesting because in Jewish thought, this is the coming of the Messiah and the setting up of the messianic kingdom. The stone cut out without hands. And later on, I'm going to get into some of the Jewish perspectives on the sanctuary. And it's amazing to see how the Jews had our message 1,500 years ago. They were preaching our message. We're just coming along and kind of tightening up their theology on it a little bit. But anyway, okay, so we've got the image. The image, the stone image, the head, the arms, legs, we know that. And the stone comes down and crashes it. Daniel comes, interprets the dream, tells the king that Babylon is the head of gold, and afterwards another kingdom, silver, shall arise, and another brass symbolizes another kingdom, then another iron, and then there's the iron will break apart, and there'll be part iron and part clay, and these will be kingdoms that will cleave one to another, and so forth, and then ultimately, boom, God sets up his kingdom. Now we know from the first kingdom, we know that that is Babylon. No problem with that. He tells them, thou art the head of gold. Okay, history reveals the next kingdom is Medo-Persia. Okay, the next one is Greece. Then the iron is Rome. Then the iron and clay mingled together as a breakup of the Roman Empire to the nations of Europe. Some people have interpreted the iron and clay as church and state, trying to mix together, which I think is a valid way of interpreting it. These things came, this exact order. And then the stone that Jesus, that comes down and smites it, is God setting up his kingdom. If you look on your charts, if you look in the corner, I put it up here. If you look on the charts, you've got a number one. On the left-hand corner, you see number one. It's just a simple outline of Daniel 2. Okay, Daniel 2. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. It's interesting because I could show you Jewish sources 2,000 years old that point to this exact order of the kingdoms. For Daniel 2, for Daniel 7, exact way we interpret it. Thousands of years ago. But a lot of times what the Jews did was, they when they talked about Rome, they would, of course, 2,000 years ago, they didn't know about Europe, but they saw the fourth kingdom as Rome. They would call it Edom. They would cover it because they didn't want to get the Romans mad at them. So they would translate the name Edom, but it's known that they were talking about the Roman Empire then. But you've got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and again, ultimately God sets up his kingdom. This is not an Adventist interpretation. People have seen this long, long time before there were ever Seventh-day Adventists. Now, there are only 2 points that I wanted to bring from Daniel 2, and then we're going to get into Daniel 7 and spend the rest of tonight in Daniel 7. 2 points that I want you to remember. The first point, and one way is, well, they're both important, but maybe the first one is the most important. Daniel 2 forms the basic foundation outline for the rest of the apocalyptic prophecies of Daniel. In other words, the rest of the prophecies really just elaborate on what is found in Daniel 2. Daniel 7, Daniel 8, and you go on. They really are just building on what's here. They basically deal with the same kingdoms in the same time frame. They just bring in more detail and bring things in from different angles. Again, this is not an Adventist innovation, Adventist understanding. Other theologians, other churches seen this as well. Daniel 2 forms the basic outline. It's the shell. You'll see Daniel 7 in a few minutes is going to elaborate on that. Daniel 8 even more. But Daniel 2 forms the basic outline of the rest of the prophecies that we are going to study. Now the other important point, and something I want you to remember again, store it on a gray shelf because you'll see later why it's important. Babylon was gold. Okay? Medo-Persia was silver. Greece was bronze and Rome is iron. Each succeeding kingdom has a different metal for it. Can you see that? Babylon 1, Medo-Persia 1, Greece 1, Rome 1. Yet Rome, which is symbolized by the iron. Okay, the iron comes up right after Greece, goes all the way down through to the time of the end, till God's kingdom is set up. That stone. So you've got iron coming up after Greece, and it goes all the way down through to the time of the end. But it changes its form. What happens to it? It becomes mixed with clay. But the point is, it's still iron. It's still the same kingdom. It just changes its form. You've got the iron coming up after Greece, and it goes all the way through until the end. It just changes its form partway through, but in the end you've got iron right there in the feet when this kingdom, when the stone cut out without hand comes. Is that clear? See that point? Different metals all the way through. Iron, different metal, but the iron goes all, it comes up after Greece, it goes through to the end. It's just in a different form. Okay? This point's clear? I mean, my whole purpose of doing this seminar is to make it simple. And if I do some repeating, you know, I give this seminar and some people come up to me and they complain, well, you repeat too much. And then other people come up and say, I'm so glad you repeat. That's the only way I can grasp it. So I'm making this as simple as I can because just I need to keep it that way, to make it simple so you can give the study to other people as well. Okay, let's just review where we've left off and then we're getting into the final chapter that we're going to look at today, Daniel 7. Judgment of God's people occurs after AD 31. Daniel 2 forms the basic prophetic outline for the rest of the apocalyptic prophecies that we're going to study in Daniel. And all the different kingdoms come up with different metals. So the iron of Rome comes up after Greece, and it goes all the way through until the end, though it just changes form. And the significance of that point will be seen later, especially when we study Daniel 8. Okay? Now, which chapter in the Bible would you say is the most crucial chapter for understanding the investigative judgment? What would be the logical answer? Daniel 8. That's a logical answer, but it's wrong.
Revelation 14.
Well, I'm dealing with Daniel. Daniel 8 is not the most important chapter. Daniel 7. See, all you really need Daniel 8 for, you need Daniel 8 for, and Daniel 9 is you get more information about the judgment and helps you nail down the date to 1844. But if all you had was Daniel 7, if all you ever had was Daniel 7, you would have the vast majority of information about the investigative judgment, including the approximate time of it. And that's what I like to look at in our last few minutes here. Okay. Daniel 7. Daniel 7, we're going to see really, all it really does is repeat Daniel 2. Repeats Daniel 2, though more details are given. More details are given. Daniel 7. Daniel himself has a dream, we know, of four great beasts coming up out of the sea. Okay, I'm hopeful we've all basically familiar Daniel 7. The first beast in verse 4 is like a lion. The second beast, verse 4, was like a bear. The third beast, verse 6, was like a leopard, though it had four wings and four heads, and the fourth beast was dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. It's verse 8. Okay, we start out, he's got a vision of four beasts coming up. Okay. Now, who are these beasts? What are these beasts? What's going on here? In the explanation of the vision, Daniel is told that they represent four kings or four kingdoms and that will arise. And the fourth beast, says verse 23, shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. Okay, so these beasts represent kingdoms. Okay, we all know that. The first beast, the lion, was Babylon. You know that. Second beast, the bear, symbolizes Medo-Persia. Being lopsided on one side says to show the imbalance of power between the two nations. Okay, the three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, are believed to be Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt. Three nations that the Medo-Persian bear crunched. The leopard, the next great world empire, symbolizing the Greeks under Alexander the Great. And the fourth beast, of course, the iron, so forth. We've got the pagan Roman Empire. Again, this is not just some kind of Adventist Millerite innovation. Bible scholars for centuries have seen this. I just the other day was glancing through the Midrash, which is an ancient Jewish commentary on the Bible. And this was glancing through the Midrash from the book of Exodus. And somehow they had all this in Exodus, that the Jews... Midrash goes back, well, they date that as late as the 12th century, but the Midrash had identified the four beasts of Daniel 7, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Edom, which we know is Rome. They just covered it that. So again, this is not just some sort of Millerite concoction. So if you look at your chart, simple enough, look at number 2 on your little handwritten chart in the corner. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome. Same order that we had in Daniel 2. Same exact order. We just got more details are given. That's all. Now, in both Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, the emphasis placed on the fourth kingdom. And in both chapters, the fourth kingdom, though symbolized by different things, they do share some similarities. Okay, the first, of course, is that they're the fourth. They come up fourth in the order. Remember Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, they both come up fourth. Both come up after Greece. Daniel 2, fourth kingdom came up after Greece. Daniel 7, fourth kingdom came up after Greece. Both are described as strong. Daniel 2:20, Daniel 7:7 describes them as strong. Both have the word iron used in their descriptions. Daniel 2:40, Daniel 7:7 and 7:19. Both kingdoms are described as breaking in pieces or breaking in pieces other powers. Both become divided into different kingdoms. Okay, so really you've got some identifying marks here that we're dealing with the same power. We know this is basically the Roman Empire. Yet in Daniel 7, another power appears. Daniel 7, we have another power coming up. This power is not separate from the fourth beast, which was pagan Rome. Instead, it comes out directly from among the 10 horns that are part of the fourth beast. Okay, verse 8. this little horn power. I consider the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Okay? This little horn power is mentioned again. Again, coming up out of the fourth beast. It's not a separate power. And out of the verse 20 and 21. And out of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up and befell, and before whom three fell, even of a horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake great things, whose look was more stout than its fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. So you got a second time, you got a description of this little horn power. Okay, you even have it again. Little horn power is even described again. Okay, verse 23 through 26. The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shred it down, and break it into pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kingdoms that shall arise. So he's giving an interpretation here of what you're seeing. And out of them shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand for a time and times and dividing of time. Okay, now, interesting point. Remember in Daniel 2, the iron that came up after Greece, the iron comes up after Greece, the fourth kingdom, it goes all the way through until the end, right? Down to the toes. But what happens partway through? Becomes mixed with clay, it changes form, but it's still iron. It's still the fourth beast all the way through and to the end. Okay? Look what you've got here in Daniel 7. We have a separate beast for Babylon, a separate beast for Medo-Persia, a separate beast for Greece, a separate beast for Rome. The fourth beast, Rome, coming right up after Greece, the third beast, comes up. Yet it moves down towards the end of time in another phase. Remember, that little horn power is still part of the fourth beast. Is that clear? It comes out from among them. So you've got the fourth beast coming up after Greece and going all the way down until that time and dividing of time. Okay? Then the God sets up his kingdom. It's still the fourth beast, but in a different phase. Is that clear? See me on that. Follow me on that. Just like in Daniel 2, iron comes up, goes all the way through, changes form. Daniel 7, fourth beast after Greece comes up, goes all the way through, it just changes form. We see that this fourth beast and the horn coming out of it, they occupy the central part of Daniel 7. They're the main, almost the whole thrust of Daniel 7, of all these beasts. More time is spent on the fourth beast than any other beast, all the other beasts combined. And more detail is given to the little horn itself than all the other beasts combined. You've got a lot of details about the little horn. Obviously, the identification of this little horn is crucial. Now, for centuries, Bible expositors have proved beyond question that this little horn power is the papacy. Again, I'm telling you, this is not just an Adventist innovation. I mean, all the reformers. Anybody here ever study the Reformation? All the reformers, Zwingli, Luther, Calvin, Melanchthon, all of them were adamant in naming the papacy as the Antichrist power and as the beast power. Martin Luther said you must be armed with Scripture so you could call the Pope the Antichrist. You must be armed with Scripture so that you can not only call the Pope the Antichrist, But to know how to prove it so clearly that you could die with this conviction and stand against the devil in death. I mean, all of them. I mean, we are just sticking with the old-time Protestant tradition, which has been completely eradicated today by the nonsense of futurism, pointing to the Middle East and so forth for these powers. I mean, all the reformers based almost the whole Reformation on their understanding of the papacy as the Antichrist, which gave them the strength to be able to stand up against Rome with the courage that they did. But anyway, I just real quickly, let's just look at some of the, these are some of the attributes of the little horn power. I just want to review it very quickly. First, the little horn power came up from pagan Rome. And we know the papacy came up from pagan Rome. It was papal Rome. That's why they call it papal Rome. It was, used to be pagan Rome. Now it's papal Rome. Fourth beast, same power, little horn just coming up out of the fourth beast. It's still Rome. The little horn came up from among the 10 barbarian tribes that picked apart pagan Rome. The papacy came up among the 10 tribes, uprooting 3 of them, just as verse 24 says, it shall uproot 3 kings. Again, I don't want to go into the details of this. The history is there. Little horn was described as diverse from the other horns, and certainly the papacy, a religious political power, was diverse from them. Even today, there's nothing quite like it in the world. The little horn was to be more stout than the other horns, and obviously it was. That's how come it was able to dominate. That's how come it eventually took control. It uprooted 3 of them. The little horn shall speak great words against the Most High. I don't need to go into that. I'm sure all of us here are familiar with the blasphemy, things that are attributed to the popes and the power, forgiveness of sins and so forth. The little horn made war with the saints. Don't need to go into that. We all know that history well enough, or we should. The power shall think to change times and laws. We certainly all know that. And I can remember when I first studied this prophecy, but years ago, first learning about the mark of the beast. I remember I went to a Catholic school and asked a woman there for a catechism. It was like to have a catechism. She said, sure, very nice. She gave me a catechism. I ran out to my car. I opened it up to the 10 commandments. And sure enough, change times and laws. There, the second commandment was deleted and the 10th was split in 2. I still have a catechism. For a Jew to read that and see that, I mean, I could not believe my eyes when I saw that. I mean, I was the kind of person, I didn't accept anything the Adventist told me. I had to check it all out for myself because I just wanted to know for sure. And that really was something to see the change. And then, I'll never forget when I read some of the statements about the change of the Sabbath, the Sunday, change times and laws. And just, here's a quote from a Catholic source in case you haven't read any in a while. The Catholic Church, for over 1,000 years before the existence of a Protestant, by virtue of her divine mission, changed the day from Saturday to Sunday. Catholic Mirror, September 23rd, 1893. Okay, now though, the final identification mark. This is the most important for us today as we narrow this study down. A time prophecy is given concerning the activity of the papacy. The saints shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and dividing of time. So in the description of the little horn power, we have our first apocalyptic time prophecy in the book of Daniel. By apocalyptic, I'm talking about the apocalypse, the end of the world. The end time, time prophecy. You're given so many identification marks about this little horn. It's so important. And we're even given our first apocalyptic time prophecy concerning this little horn power. Time, times, and dividing of time. Now again, scholars, I don't have time to go into all this now. We'll look into it later if you want. Time, times, and dividing of time. It's translated 3.5 years. Okay, again, this is something, again, you can go back to Jewish sources and see the same understanding of this. Time, time, and dividing of time. 3.5 years. Okay. In Revelation 12, the same power is given. Time, time, and dividing of time, and it's equated with 1260 days. Prophetic years, 360 years. 360 days to a year. Revelation 12, 1 year is 360 days, 2 years, 720 days, half a year, 180 days, total 1,260 days. Now what I want to talk about, the year-day principle. Now, I'm not going to spend time today, now, dealing with the year-day principle. I promise you though, I will show you how beyond question you have to use the year-day principle in Daniel 7, 8, 9. I don't want to get bogged down right now in the year-day principle. Explain that we've got a lot more evidence for the year-day principle than Numbers and Ezekiel. Okay, just take my word for it now that you apply the year-day principle here. Okay, so we've got this time and dividing of time, 1260 days, 1260 year period for the papacy. Okay, the saints are going to be given into his hand, 1260 years. Now, does that fit? We've got all these other identification marks of the papacy, which fits beyond question. That's papacy. I mean, if somebody could come up and show a better interpretation, I'm open. But everything I've seen is utter nonsense in trying to put another interpretation on that. Okay? Now, in 1698, remember the year now, 1698, a British Bible expositor named Drew Kressner, from studying the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation, he came to the conclusion, number one, he did three things. He applied the year-day principle. He said that something drastic was going to happen to the papacy. He applied the prophecy of the papacy, applied the year-day principle, and said something drastic was going to happen to the papacy about the year 1800. Remember, in 1698, doing what we're doing with these prophecies, the year-day principle, he said something drastic is going to happen to the papacy about the year 1698. Okay, and then we know the last Arian tribe was uprooted for Rome, 538, exactly 1260 years later, the Pope was taken captivity. You could find that in Catholic literature. You could find that, the date, Catholic literature. Exactly 1260 years later, Pope taken captive. Now we know that although the papacy received a deadly wound here, it later revived, and in Revelation focuses in on it more in detail. Revelation goes in more detail and brings out, you know, the wound being healed and so on and so forth. But you've got 538 to 1798 coming out to this prophecy. Again, Kressner in 1698 made that prediction. Something would happen to the papacy a little bit about the year 1800. It'd be like somebody in the 1880s predicting who the next president is going to be. Again, as I said, almost all the Protestants saw this interpretation of Rome. Okay, even in the 1400s, even before the Reformation, a Jewish Bible expositor named Isaac Abravanel wrote, "I have come to the conclusion that the little horn was the rule of the Pope." The 1400s, this is before even the Reformation. And he didn't even have the time prophecy that we had. So far, what have we seen in chronological order? We've seen Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, and papal Rome. But what now comes after papal Rome in the prophecy? And now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. Look on your chart on number 3. "I consider the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom were three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." The little horn power. What comes next? "And I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set and the books were open. There was given him dominion, glory, and a kingdom." It goes on and on. So verse 8 describes his little horn power. What immediately comes next in verses 9 and 10? We see thrones cast down, the Ancient of Days we recognize as God. We see fiery streams, 10,000 times 10,000 beings before him. And finally, the judgment was set and the books were open. So what comes after this little horn power? A judgment. Can you see that? A judgment scene in heaven. Can you follow the order here? Little horn power, judgment scene, and then ultimately God sets up his kingdom. Go back and study that again tonight if you have the time. Look at the specific order of events that we have in these verses. We have this little horn power, which in all three descriptions comes up after the fourth beast, part of the fourth beast. Then a judgment scene in heaven and God sets up his kingdom. This is a point I'm trying to reach, the whole conclusion of everything. Little horn, judgment in heaven, God sets up his kingdom. Go back and read these verses till you see that order. The sequence is so important that we have it again. We have it again. Verse 21 and 22. I beheld the same horde made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given in favor of the saints or in behalf of the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Again, number four in your chart. You've got this order. Little horn power. After the little horn power, you've got the judgment scene in heaven. Then you've got God setting up his kingdom. You've got that twice. Can you see that? And then you have it again. It's so important to even have it a third time in the chapter. That's how crucial it is. Verses 25 through 27. And starts out talking about the little horn. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. And they shall think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and dividing of time. 3.5 years, 1260 days, 1260 prophetic years, your first apocalyptic time prophecy, nailing down this little horn. After that, but the judgment shall sit. Coming next is the judgment. And then they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. God setting up his kingdom. Here we have a description of the little horn power, which is ends with its the first apocalyptic time prophecy in Daniel, which delineates a phase of the little horn. After this little horn, we have a judgment scene in heaven. Judgment is given in favor of the saints, in behalf of the saints. So obviously it's a judgment involving God's people. Okay, and finally God sets up his kingdom. The sequence is found three times like this. Look at number six of your chart. This is crucial. This is a crucial point we're coming to now. You've got little horn, judgment in heaven, and God setting up his kingdom. Can you see that order there? Go back. We're running out of time now. I'd like to spend a few more minutes on this to make sure this point is hammered in. You've got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, papal Rome, which is still part of it, and then you've got the judgment scene in heaven, God sets up his kingdom. Now, we saw earlier, everything in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 is chronological, is it not? Babylon comes, after Babylon comes Medo-Persia. After Medo-Persia comes Greece. After Greece comes Rome, pagan and papal Rome. Then you've got the judgment in heaven, and God sets up his kingdom. Can you follow that order? Can you see that, how it's chronological? It's moving right down the line in time. One nation, then another nation, then another nation, then another nation. Judgment in heaven, God sets up his kingdom. First was Babylon. After Babylon was Medo-Persia. After Medo-Persia was Greece. After Greece was Rome, pagan and papal Rome. After pagan and papal Rome comes the judgment in heaven, and God sets up his kingdom. Is that clear? So can you see how the judgment in heaven occurs after the time, times, and dividing of time of the little horn power in Daniel 7? Is that clear? It's important. If you can't see that, go back and study that till you see it. That's a crucial point. Now, Babylon ended in 539 B.C. That's the end of Babylon. 539 B.C. After 539 B.C. comes what? What great nation comes up after Babylon? Medo-Persia. So after 539 comes Medo-Persia. Okay? Medo-Persia ends, look at number 7 on your charts. After Medo-Persia, which ends in 331, comes what? Greece. Greece ends in what year? Okay? 168 B.C. After 168 B.C., we've got pagan and papal Rome. Okay, that fourth beast and that little horn is still the same power, right? Still the same power. The little horn comes out of the fourth beast. Okay? We've got our first apocalyptic time prophecy, our first delineation of time. That's how important it is. When did that phase of Rome end? 1798. What comes after 1798? You've got a judgment in heaven. Judgment was given in favor of the saints, in behalf of the saints. So obviously the saints are involved in this judgment. They're really being judged. If judgment is given in their behalf, in their favor, then obviously they're being judged. And then what ultimately happens? God sets up His kingdom. So can you see what I'm trying to show you here? That we've got a judgment in heaven involving believers that comes after what date? 1798. Can you see that? Again, go back. Follow Babylon. After Babylon, Medo-Persia. After Medo-Persia, Greece. After Greece, Rome. Pagan and papal Rome. After that, in Daniel 7, God sets up His kingdom. And after that, you've got the judgment. Got it up here. Babylon 539. After 539, Medo-Persia. After Medo-Persia 331 is Greece. After 168 is Rome. After 1798, after that phase of the little horn, which we're given three times the little horn, judgment occurs in heaven. Judgment obviously dealing with God's people. Judgment which we believe is the investigative judgment. And then God sets up His kingdom. So can you see from Daniel 7 alone, how you've got a judgment of believers in heaven, occurring in heaven after the year 1798. Can you see? Again, if it's not clear, go back and study this stuff, reread it and reread it. It's really, in the end, very simple. Well, anyway, to close, what have we shown? Judgment of God's people occurs after AD 31. Judgment involving God's people occurs after 1798, after that phase of the little horn power. A lot of information is given about that little horn power. It needs to be identified. It's important. After that phase, the time and dividing of time, you've got a judgment in heaven, obviously involving God's people. Then God sets up His kingdom. So we could see that we've got the judgment occurring after 1798. And that's where I want to close with today. We've still got to narrow it down to 1844. And we'll do that tomorrow and Sabbath, and then we'll deal with some any questions you might have. Okay, let's have a word of prayer. Father in heaven, just thank you for the privilege of being here. And Lord, I just pray that you'll impress upon the people the need to study these things out further, to know these things for themselves. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.